talk often on this show about supporting the troops, not just when they're in the field in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the rest of the world, but sometimes it's even more important to support them when they come home, particularly when they get banged up. Well, this is a story today not of a member of the United States military, but a guy who worked for the United States government and worked side by side with the military, not as a private contractor, but as a civilian counterintelligence expert. His name is Mike Helms. He was working with the Army's 902nd Military Intelligence Group when he was sent to Iraq in 2004, working in the Sunni Triangle, a pretty dangerous part of Iraq, living with soldiers and eating military rations, went out on a Humvee one day, and came back in pieces. When he came back to the United States, the government that he worked for didn't do its job in taking care of him. So when we talk about soldiers not getting the care they need from the Pentagon and the VA, we should also include in that the civilian workers for the United States government who are not getting the attention they need from the Pentagon and the rest of the U.S. government. I've invited Mike to join me here this afternoon on KMOX to tell his story. How are you today, Mike?
I'm good. Thank you for having me today, Mr. Harrison.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for coming on here. Tell me when you got in trouble on top of that Humvee. When was that?
Well, it was a little background, 16 June 2004, and we were traveling on the Samar bypass just right in the middle of, or top of the Sunni Triangle, and that particular day was pretty bad. Several convoys had been hit by an IED in almost the exact same spot, the improvised explosive device, and that particular day, the guys in the vehicle that were with me, which were the first sergeant who was driving, the company commander who was in the passenger seat, and we had just gotten in 40 or 50 new soldiers 2 or 3 days before, and the reason for the convoy on that particular day was to take them out to their locations. And they were sitting in the two back seats, and then I was standing in the back of the Humvee, strapped in with a cargo strap, manning the machine gun. At that particular time, back on this side of the world, the up-armor issue was coming up for the Humvees, and we were just starting to get all the armor, but our vehicle, being the command vehicle, we chose not to have the up-armor until all the other vehicles in our command, all the soldiers, had it first. So we still had just basically a standard Humvee, and I had the turret or the machine gun mount welded into the back of the Humvee, so if the inevitable, which did happen, I wouldn't be thrown out any worse than I was. That particular afternoon, the guy said, and I don't remember this, the guy said, I screamed IED. They reacted, but it completely blew us off the road, blew the whole left front side off the vehicle, blew the doors off, blew my machine gun off, blew several guys' weapons out of their hands, and they say we're still going 60 miles an hour, and the individuals behind us said they just saw my body just flopping around in the back because I was just unconscious. I came to momentarily. I remember that particular moment, and then next thing I know, I'm sitting on the road, and they had taken me, they had cut me out and put me on the stretcher, and I just, everything was practically gone. Almost everything was burned off or blown off of my body.
Was this your first time out on a convoy like that?
No. I had almost 4,000 miles on the road since I had gotten in country in December 2003.
And what was your role there? What were you doing on that Humvee?
I was the machine gunner. That was the decision that that we had to make due to lack of personnel to go on the convoy.
So even though you were a civilian, you were forced into a military role there, manning that machine gun?
Kind of, sort of, yes, sir. It was a conscious decision several of us had to make because the troops that were coming over weren't properly trained. And living in the Sunni Triangle, I could not consciously, being in a leadership position, could not consciously put a soldier up there that did not know the difference between an open bolt and a closed bolt position on a machine gun, and put him in the position where he has to make the decision whether to shoot or not to shoot. and I didn't want to put my life at risk or any other soldier's life at risk. So that was decisions that we made over there. That was a life or death situation, and it worked out very well all the previous times. It just happened to be, it's not a fact of when it's going to, or if it's going to happen. It's just a matter of fact of when it's going to happen over there. It's just inevitable.
And in addition to being the machine gunner on this convoy, what was your role in Iraq overall? What was your job there?
What we were sent over there to do is provide backfill the human intelligence support for all of Iraq from Baghdad north. It was during the transition of OIF-1 to OIF-2 where the heavy brigade 4ID, 3rd ID was coming out, and they did not have the intelligence personnel in country to help identify incoming threats of a terrorist attack or some other time-sensitive material. So I managed tactical HUMET teams through the whole Sunni Triangle. So I managed all their daily operations and all their reports and sent them forward, respectively, to the proper areas, and then slowly kind of became the machine gunner at the same time. That way I could go out and see all of my teams and make sure they were doing all their paperwork properly and also support them with beans, bullets, the basic necessities.
It's News Talk 1120 KMOX. Paul Harris talking with Mike Helms, who was in Iraq in 2004 as a civilian counterintelligence expert with the Army's 902, the Military Intelligence Group. He had been there and had gone out on many, many missions and had been across hundreds, if not thousands, of miles of Iraq until that day in the middle of June 2004 when an IED blew apart the Humvee he was riding in so hard. It blew the M60 machine gun that he was manning right off the turret, right off the Humvee, and put him eventually in a stretcher on the side of the road with shrapnel wounds and burns and all sorts of things. And you took a pretty good shot to the head, too. You ended up with TBI, traumatic brain injury. Is that right?
Yes. There were actually, when they found my helmet, it had been hit five times with shrapnel on the inside and outside.
Mm.
The blast was so large that we were 2 kilometers away from the forward operating base. They felt and saw the blast, and it was just the doctors really, and no one really understood how we even survived. It was such a large blast.
Now let's get to the meat of the story, which is what happened after you were injured. As a member of the military, you probably would have been brought back and helped out at Walter Reed.
Yes.
We've heard about problems at Walter Reed with outpatient, but they still do a tremendous job with our returning soldiers when they come back and need that initial care. You were first flown to Germany, right, and got some care there?
Correct. The reason they finally ended up medevacing me so fast was my ears were just constantly bleeding, and we were heavily mortared one night, and I didn't even know it. So they took me to the medical facility, and they said, you're on the next bird out. I got to Germany, and they initially treated me for my ears and said, okay, you got to go to Walter Reed. But that's where a lot of problems started. While in Iraq, there was no question on my status or who I worked for. Now, as a federal employee, not as a contractor, I wasn't working for Blackwater. I wasn't with any other contractor. I was a federal GS employee, and a lot of people get confused with that. The DOD policy states that I will be treated equal. I'm former Army, and if I was still in reserve status, they could have treated me that way. But somewhere in the system initially, they believe I got coded incorrectly while I was at Launchville, but all they did was dope me up. I mean, I could not tell you the time of day or anything. They didn't allow me to stay in the barracks. I had to get the guest house. I had to pay for that. And then once it got time for me to fly out, my orders had ran out, so we had to get that problem fixed in order for me to fly to Walter Reed. I landed in Walter Reed on 2 July, so it was a holiday weekend, so they wouldn't admit me. And the driver of the Humvee had already beat me or had already been admitted like almost 3 days earlier, so he was ahead of me 3 days. So I stayed with him and his wife in their room those over the weekend until 5 July, went back to the hospital to get admitted or to at least be processed in.
Now, days are going by here, and you're not getting any care.
No, sir.
Well, and what's your physical condition at this point?
It was pretty bad. I could not even tell you because I don't remember. I was so out of it. The other individual, the first sergeant's wife, luckily was a nurse and drastically helped me out because otherwise I'd have been out of it. I mean, I probably would have been walking down the road and never would have even told you, known where I was. I mean, she was critical in getting me what care I did get at Walter Reed. She, on 5 July, when I went in to try to get it in process and they refused, she immediately went to the hospital commander complaining, saying, listen, the guy's wounded. What do you mean you're not going to treat a civilian? He's considered a wounded warrior in Iraq. Why is he not considered a wounded warrior here? And the answers given back were, he's a civilian. We don't treat civilians here. He needs to go on his way. She fought some more. I was able to get seen at a couple of doctors. But during that time, I could not even get a room at the Malone house or in the hospital. So I had to stay with him and his family in their room.
When they say he has to go on his way, what does that mean?
They told me they were not going to treat me. So I needed to go see my civilian doctor.
And that should not have been the case. This is all because you were coded wrong in Germany, right?
Well, I tend to disagree with that. That's what the Army believes. I tend to believe it was lack of education because they did not know really what to do with civilians. They just assumed that, hey, wait a minute, civilians, oh, you must be a contractor. We're not going to treat contractors. And I kept showing my ID card, and they said no. Even when I did get some care at Walter Reed, when I go to the pharmacy, and wounded warriors are supposed to get ahead of the line to get treatment, they immediately said, nope, you have to wait, just like everyone else. Every time I'd go forth and try to do something, I just kept hitting brick walls. A couple of behavior health clinic, when I had to go in there and get my initial diagnosis of anything to see if I had a traumatic brain injury and all, the people at the front desk absolutely did not want me there, and I sat there for 8 hours before the first sergeant's wife came and found me and said, "What have you been?" And I said, "Here all day." I mean, the only thing they did give me was lots and lots and lots of Percocet. And ever since then, it's been almost impossible to get consistent care.
I'm talking with Mike Helms, who is a civilian counterintelligence expert with the Army's 902nd Military Intelligence Group, who was sent to Iraq in 2004 to help fill up an intelligence gap that was going on in the Sunni Triangle. This is not unusual for civilians to be called up there, not as contractors, but as employees of the federal government. Mike was not in the military, but he was attached to the military and was riding along with one of the units that he had been with so many, many times along a road through the northern part of the Sunni Triangle on June 16, 2004, when the Humvee he was riding in, which was not yet up-armored, was hit with an IED, or rather hit an IED, blew up, and he suffered some traumatic injuries. Shrapnel in his arm, traumatic brain injury, burning on a good part of his flesh. He was eventually airlifted to Germany, to the U.S. military base there, and they didn't do much for him but send him home, home being the USA, where he went to Walter Reed and was told, you're not in the Army, we can't serve you here. You're a civilian. You'll have to find your own care elsewhere. Have I brought everybody up to speed on where we are, Mike?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so once they told you that, and they wouldn't help you out, they wouldn't give you the care that you needed, and you hadn't really received any for several days since coming back home, what did you do?
Well, I was in a state of daze. The first sergeant's wife kept trying and trying and trying, and I got seen by the defense brain injury clinic only because her husband was being seen, and she convinced that specific clinic to see me, who diagnosed me with a traumatic brain injury. After that, it was pretty much, which that process took several days, maybe in a week. I don't remember much of my whole stay at Walter Reed other than what she took down in notes and and refresh my memory on.
But once it was clear that you were not going to get the care that you needed there, you had to go out into the civilian world.
Right.
And does your personal medical insurance kick in then, or what?
That's where it turned into a huge problem. My personal medical insurance would not pay for anything sustained in Iraq because of the on-the-job injury. So the reason I found this out the hard way was somehow or another, the medevac flight from Iraq to Germany got charged to my insurance of $1,200, which I got a bill.
Oh.
Yeah. And I said, wait a minute, what's going on? Well, come to find out, unknown to me, all of a sudden I have to be on workers' compensation. And I said, okay, what are the guidelines on this? Well, you only get 45 days of paid time, and then you either have to take a leave of absence or you have to go on your own leave. So during that time, I'm trying to figure out what to do. No guidance. No one knows really what's left, what's right. And after 45 days, I'm stuck, and I started taking leave of absence to try to figure out what's going on.
In those 45 days, had you gotten any care?
No.
So now weeks have gone by.
Oh, months.
Months have gone by.
Yes.
And you still have not been taken care of. Obviously, you weren't in a state where you couldn't walk, were you? I mean, were you getting around?
Yeah, I was getting around, but as it's happened in the last 3 years, they just keep every doctor I do go see just increases medication because they do not want to mess with me because that's not their specialty.
All right, now if I know how bureaucracies work in this country, this is what happened to you. The military said you can't get help from us because you're a civilian. So as a civilian, you went to your insurance company and they said, well, that was technically on the job, so it's workers' compensation. And then workers' compensation said, well, it may have been your job, but you were at war, and so it's a military thing. And that's the whole circle that you ended up in. Am I right?
That's part of it, yes. And it's still ongoing. It's a vicious cycle, even dealing with workers' comp, because no physician wants to really accept them because they do not pay expeditiously. The paperwork involved in it is tremendous, and I'm 3 years into it, and I still haven't been treated for half of my traumatic brain injury problems. As a matter of fact, last week I went up to do informal testimony for the Subcommittee on Oversight Investigations for the House Armed Forces Services because after 3 years, I had finally given up trying to fight the bureaucracy and went public. And they could not believe the bureaucracy involved in workers' compensation. It was never designed to deal with wartime injuries.
Of course not.
And to me, it's somewhat demeaning to tell me when I go in to see Department of Labor, well, we don't care, literally this is a statement made to me, we don't care if you're carrying a letter or carrying a bomb, this is all you're going to get.
Oh.
And I took that to heart. And I had to walk out. I literally had to walk out. After 3 years of trying to get something from them, I get to go see them finally, and that's the type of statement that's made to me. I lost it. And I said, I don't know what it takes to try to get support from you guys. And now they want more medical documentation from a doctor that says, yes, this is not pre-existing. How in the world do you get... And literally, the doctor's notes were not good enough for this traumatic brain injury. And they wanted the doctor to write a letter stating that this is not pre-existing.
Yeah, the broken tailbone and the ear injuries and the nerve damage and the burned skin and the shrapnel and the TBI. You must have had that before you came in here to make this claim. How ridiculous are these people? Can they look you in the eye and say that to you?
Yes, and believe it or not, the claims examiners for Department of Labor are not medical people. They are just...
pencil pushers.
Yes. And they get paid for how many they push out. And I don't know how many times my claim's been denied. And furthermore, when I got back last week, it's taken 10 months to get the process of going in to see this PCP that is in this network I'm in down here, who said, his billing office said, yes, initially we'll take workers' comp. And I kept bugging and bugging and bugging the last 3 months, wanting to make sure before I walk in there, I'm not going to get denied again because I can't handle it much more.
Sure.
And when I went in there, lo and behold, the front desk said, well, He's not accepting workers' comp because, one, workers' comp does not cover everything. It only covers what is on the piece of paper, and I said, I understand. That's all I want him to treat me for. I have my own PCP for, you know, when I have a cold and everything else. And number two, he did not want to, he felt it was a conflict of interest, and I understand, to try to treat me for just those issues as a primary care provider, but yet he sees something else, and then what does he do? And these are issues I asked about 3 years ago how to deal with, and after my informal testimony last week, DOD issued a new updated policy letter saying that the military system will treat civilians at no cost to them.
Well, that's good, but how does that affect you?
Right. It's a 360-degree vicious cycle that I stated 3 years ago with the initial policy letters that stated you can, you will. I'm tired of getting the bills.
You can't possibly be alone in your predicament, Mike. I mean, there have got to be lots of other people who have gone over there working for the federal government alongside our military and been injured just like you. What's happened with them?
From my understanding, from the testimony last week, they announced there was 118 others. But I believe there's more that had just finally said, I'm not going to deal with it. I'll pay for out of pocket because the bureaucracy levels are just so high. Since I've been back, this has become my life because I do not want anyone else to have to deal with what I've lived through.
And what was Congress's response? Did they seem like they wanted to make some changes?
Yeah, they were receptive, but it was a closed, informal discussion. So I'm hoping that they're going to call me back for open testimony. I think by the end of the informal hearing, they were all in agreement that part of it, Department of Labor needs to be detached from combat injuries. There needs to be a distinction between I broke my leg and I sustained mortar round.
Yeah. And you are still attached to the Army Intelligence and Security Command, right?
Yes, sir. I'm still actively working, but on a restricted 6-hour work days since I've been back.
Based at Fort Knox?
Yes, sir.
Well, I say this to everyone in uniform, and I'm going to say it to you as well. Thank you for your service. I hope that your government steps up and does what's right for you and the others who are in your situation, and I really appreciate you taking the time to tell your story first person here today.
I appreciate it.
Mike Helms here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.